Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. So, how much does front-of-pack information affect the food choices we make? Many people have diet and health in mind when they shop, but it can be a challenge to work out which products are actually good for us. Nutritional labelling is supposed to help us along the way, but how effective is it? Since the introduction of the traffic light system in the UK, obesity numbers have risen. So is it doing any good? Health claims are sometimes made or implied, but these don't often give us the full picture. And what impact might sustainability labelling have on our food choices if it comes in? And underlying all of this, the big question is, does any of the information on food packaging actually make a difference to our diets and our health? So lots of questions. How do we make food labelling clearer, more transparent, and more relevant? Well, here to discuss this with me are two absolutely fabulous guests. Joe Tucker is Senior Lecturer in the College of Hospitality and Tourism at the University of West London. Hello there, Joe.
Oh, good afternoon.
Great to have you with us. And Zoe Davies is the Nutritionist for the charity Action on Salt and Action on Sugar. Hello, Zoe.
Hello.
Great to have you as well. So first of all, let's talk about the system that we have already here in the UK, the traffic light system. Things like salt, sugar and fat content of a product are listed. Red is bad, green is good. But obviously there's a lot of complication around this. In your view, let's start with you, Zoe. Is it an effective system?
So, I mean, it's been around since about 2013, so around 10 years now. Some food companies started using some form of front-of-pack labelling before this. Then the government decided to bring about guidance, not only to encourage all companies to use the front-of-pack labelling, but to standardise the format for consumers to understand. And about 3 in 4 products now display the labels. So it is effective. The World Health Organization recommends it to help reduce diseases and illnesses such as heart disease, stroke and type 2 diabetes. They help people see at a glance if a product is high or low in salt, sugar, fat, and colour coding has been shown to be clear and understandable. Red doesn't necessarily define bad and green doesn't necessarily define good. Red shows high, green shows low. So it's useful for many people. So someone living with high blood pressure, for example, it helps them see what products are high in salt. Someone with diabetes, it helps them identify high in sugar. And some with watching their cholesterol, looking out for their saturated fat. So we often think these labels are only for consumers, but actually they are effective in encouraging food industry, food companies to improve their products, reducing the levels of salt, sugar and saturated fat to avoid having that red label display.
So the sort of the nudge effect of having to put it on the label means, oh gosh, because red, I know you say that red doesn't mean bad, but it implies something negative. And so you reckon that there will be reformulation amongst companies to try and get that traffic light yellow and green if they can?
That's right. And Tesco and Co-op, for example, on their websites, they state and they're trying to reduce the number of red labels on their own brand products. So they're using it as a way to show that, hey, we're creating healthier products, for example. So it's doing well for a voluntary system, despite protests from the food industry in the past. Mandatory would obviously be better, then all products would have it. And it would mean that companies are on that same level playing field.
Okay, so Zoe said that 3 out of 4 products have it, but across Europe they're rolling out a different system, and of course they're vying for which system's the better one. What's your view on it? Is it an effective system? Is it helpful?
So we had a back of pack on our products since December 2016, which had to be on the back of a product which was legislated. Now, the back of the pack had energy fat, of which are saturates. It had, in addition to the traffic light, it had carbohydrates and it had protein. But basically the whole nutritional information has been there before. It's been there for a while. It is only recently that we've added these colour codes. So for the advantages of these points, it does give, as Zoe said, a great quick visual comparison between your products. If I'm looking for something low in cholesterol, I can look at the fat. The consumer identifies with red and green. So it's very quick. It provides a very informative choice. And it's set against a very specific criteria. So if it's saying it's low in fat, the whole products and everybody's products and manufacturers have to abide by that criteria. However,
I'm just warming up.
let's get going. Okay, so it's voluntary. Now, as far as I'm concerned, that's an inconsistent message. And I think the way I look at this is that we need the whole of the food environment to pick up on. It's no good just having you walk into a supermarket and pick up a lasagna. God forbid you're not making it from scratch. But if you did, and you couldn't compare that own brand to somebody else's brand and have a look at it, but then you can go to a restaurant and you have no idea what you're comparing it to. So I think we need to have a wider loop that comes into this, and it needs to be mandatory. Some of the other points I'd like to point out is that it can have a saturated, it can have a fat, and it tells you which are the saturated fats, but it doesn't tell you which are the good fats, so which is just as important when you are choosing your food. I don't really think on one of the advantages and disadvantages as such that consumers really understand either an amber, the sort of waiver in between. Mm. The words that they use on the website is eat foods with all or mostly amber on the label most of the time. Bit wishy-washy. I love that saying, wishy-washy. I think red and green is seen as good and bad, and I don't think we should pigeonhole certain foods for this. And some of the foods that could also be green could have a very high fat content, but again, that could be good fat. So again, lots of dietitians argue the fact that the red and green is not great, but then, you know, hey, total sugars are on the label, which again are, it includes free sugars, which free sugars are the ones that run or added by manufacturers. So it doesn't necessarily include, it also includes natural sugars. So I think there can be some confusion. So it takes a really long time to work this all out. It's okay to pick up two products and look between two products, three or four possibly along the shelf, but it's passive. You have to really engage with what does it say? How does it add up? And I did a little thing here, but I forgot, because as I'm used to so much lecture, I'm used to giving a little handout, and unfortunately I can't give this to anybody that's listening. And this little handout would say, right, okay, I've gone in and I've got a finest selection hot ham sandwich with an ale and onion chutney and whole grain bread. I've got hand-cooked creamy cheddar cheese, obviously finest. And I've got a small carton of freshly squeezed orange juice. Try and work that out with where you are on your basket. It's terribly, terribly confusing. And then we throw in something called a reference intake, which again, oh, let's not even go there. Maths is not my forte. But, you know, how much of something can you consume in a day? So I think we have a problem with all this calculation and this passiveness of getting all this information on board and computing it. And unfortunately, I'm going to move to my last point. Sorry, Zoe, because you'll all fall asleep. I think that the biggest problem is the people who tend to have a better education use and read food labels more than many other people. These people who are better educated tend to, very generic, very general comment in case you get complaints, have a higher income. Therefore, they can select better quality food, pay more for better quality, and thus making the health inequality gap even bigger.
There we go. What's interesting here for me is that what we're doing with front-of-pack labelling is we're taking the vast depth of knowledge that you both have of years of studying and understanding the subject and trying to boil it down into something short, quick and easy for the consumer. Now, I don't know if you've read the latest Tim Spector book, but he sort of takes apart ingredients and foods and concepts of nutrition in such great detail that it basically, instead of informing you, sort of makes it totally impenetrable. And you kind of go, okay, it's impossible for me to make decent choices here because the complexity is so vast. So what's the solution here, Zoe? I mean, you sounded quite positive about the traffic light system, and I get the idea that it's better to do something than nothing, but is a little bit of knowledge a dangerous thing?
I mean, is it a little knowledge or versus no knowledge? As Joe like very rightly pointed out, there is so much that we can unravel and so much that we could include on packaging. But what will be useful, what won't be useful, what will cause confusion, what do consumers know, what don't they know, where do we then have awareness, how do we do the awareness, do we do awareness on everything? Sometimes simple is better than nothing, yeah. And it's a kind of a basis to where we could then go further.
Yeah, which is a great start. So I understand that there's a nebulousness. There's so much information there. So I guess that an easier approach might be to ask, is there any evidence that front of pack nutritional labelling influences consumer purchasing decisions at all?
So our team did do a paper overview on the published evidence on three main front of pack labels. So that's looking at the traffic light system in the UK. Nutri-Score, so that's used in, for example, France and Belgium, warning labels, for example, in Chile and Mexico, and all directed consumers to more healthy purchases, so reducing the energy, salt, saturated fat, sugar of the processed foods and drinks that were then purchased and chosen. The traffic lights and the Nutri-Score, they tended to highlight the positive aspects of a product and encourage purchasing of healthier products, whereas the warning labels highlighted the negative aspects and discouraged purchasing of less healthy products. So two different mechanisms, but essentially with the same result. It's hard to say if one's better than the other, as they're all created and tested in the countries that use them. So consumers are likely to prefer the label that they're already used to. As we already have and understand the traffic light system in the UK, it's best to probably stick with that. But the government would fully benefit from evaluating the traffic light labels to see their impact on the food companies and consumers and make improvements as needed.
I wanted to go back to Zoe's point about some of the studies.
Go for it.
What I was going to say was when people do report on the effectiveness or the influence, should I say, the influence of a food label on purchasing, there so many of these are done in a laboratory setting. And so many of these are done when people are not consuming the food. So you'll be given a choice of pre-packed foods and asked which ones would you choose. And then you're given a pre-packed one with the labels saying which ones would you choose. And there's this sort of almost an effect of whereby, A, they're not eating it, so it doesn't necessarily count as a change in behaviour. And B, they might understand that they are, and I'm not saying under duress, but they are knowing that they are being looked at, monitored, asked, recorded. And therefore, then, if we do this, we need real food choices in a real life setting to measure the effectiveness of whether this actually works. So when we're looking at all this information, I totally agree with Zoe that there is so much on the front of pack that we have to go with what we've got almost. I agree with that as well, but we just have to strip it back, in my opinion.
Yeah. And from your position, working for Action on Salt and Action on Sugar, do you get the sense that it's the products that are high in salt and sugar that do not take up the voluntary labelling?
It's a mixture. As I said earlier, there's quite a few products that do now use it. It is a complete mixture, but yes, in some cases, it makes it very difficult, as Joe mentioned, to compare products if one has it and one doesn't. Yeah. And sometimes you do think, why is that? Is that one particularly higher? And sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't.
That's interesting that there's not, yes, it's not the demons that are avoiding the view of the consumer. I wanted to drift away from the sort of traffic light system and talk a little bit about health claims, because they add to the fuzz of information on packaging. And, you know, we might see very simple words like organic or natural or superfood on products. They evoke a sense of healthiness, even if it isn't necessarily or always the case. Do you think that these can be misleading in practice? Do you think people are looking beyond the headline claims?
Well, there's two claims. There is, let's look at the nutrition claims. The nutrition claims relate to the product, what it does or doesn't contain. So it can say it doesn't contain salt, or it could say so doesn't contain sugar, sugar-free. It can say low fat, it could say high in fiber, all of these things. They are nutritional claims that are, you have to go through several hoops to be able to allow yourself to have these on. Just like the traffic light system, they are monitored, they are regulated, and, you know, all kudos to those people for doing it and having strict criteria. A health claim are claims that suggest there's a relationship between the product and consuming it and their health. Now, they cannot claim that it will prevent disease or cure disease or actually give any indication of weight loss. They cannot do that. But they can say things like iron contributes to normal oxygen in the body, or vitamin D is needed for normal growth and development of bones. And I have thoughts on this, which I could pontificate.
No, please do. I mean, because I think they're sometimes a bit weaselly, aren't they?
Well, my opinion is, if you do need a specific nutrient, let's just take vitamin D, for example. It's quite a hot topic. I did my master's on vitamin D, and there's so much out there and so much confusion, and so many people take supplements that they don't necessarily know they need or need. So I think if you do need a specific nutrient for your health, and you have gone to the GP for this, the GP will give you a list of foods that you are should consume or widen your consumption of. So you can check on the NHS. The NHS website is, I fully embrace it. I think it's up to date, it's clear, it's well written. So in my opinion, despite the strict regulation, I think it adds to just confusion, and it's a very, very strong form of marketing for the product.
Yeah.
Overtakes the health claims, overtakes the health of it, and the decision-making and purchasing, because you just go, oh, well, look, it's high in fiber. I mean, hundreds of foods are high in fiber, more so or less high in fiber, low in fiber.
Yeah.
So I would, if I had my way, ruling the world, which I don't, thank goodness, I'm far too busy, far too busy. But if I was, I'd take these both off and say they are not needed, in my opinion.
Yeah. So this is a really interesting point, isn't it? So Zoe, I mean, the companies want to, you know, there are lots of companies who quite fairly want to promote the healthy aspects of their products and give that prominence on packaging, but it can twist the message. It can confuse, it can confound by, you know, you can put lots of information on there that sort of, that dilutes the negative aspects possibly. What's the answer for all of this? Do you think that more regulation about what goes on packaging is either useful or needed?
Yeah, so it is understandable companies want to promote healthy aspects of their products, but at what point should this be allowed if they are high in salt, sugar or saturated fat, if, as you said, it hides the unhealthiness of the product, misleads us into thinking we're buying unhealthy products like Joe mentioned. So, I mean, a key example of this, and I know Joe gave quite a few examples, but it's the use of the term, say, no added sugar, mm-hmm. for example, in products that can be high in what is labelled as only naturally occurring sugars, because the ingredients include processed fruit. So legally, this is allowed because the definition doesn't include the free sugars from processed fruit. But we know that when we process fruit, this turns sugars from the whole fruit into free sugars, which are harmful to health. Now, this is particularly worrying, especially when used in products marketed for babies and infants. So it's that aspect of promoting something seemingly healthy in a product which we would all then feel or deem as suitable for little ones, but in reality they're a source of free sugars which aren't suitable and shouldn't be consumed by under 2-year-olds at all. And all that this marketing has done is mislead parents. At the moment, there's no link between the use of front of pack labels and health and nutrition claims, because they were controlled by two different departments. So now we're out of the EU, we might as well use that opportunity to develop legislation to then link the two. So potentially making the traffic lights mandatory, and then having criteria where if a product is high in any nutrient, for example, if it's high in sugar, salt, saturated fat, then a nutrition claim, health claim cannot be used. So legislation, it creates a level playing field where all companies follow the same guidelines, yeah. with the same standards and definitions, which is really important. And this also doesn't put those who are responsible wanting to make changes at disadvantage if others don't. But when we're thinking about regulation versus awareness among consumers, firstly, why does it need to be one versus the other? Awareness does have a role to play somewhere. But secondly, what is the point of teaching people to ignore health claims just so the industry can use them when they could not be used?
Yeah, absolutely.
So you will never reach everyone with just awareness. So yes, we do need legislation.
Yeah. Okay. So, Joe, the problem surrounding food label, I wonder if do we know anything about the fact that there might be a psychological aspect to this? That, you know, for example, if you eat something labeled as low in fat, are you likely to then think that you deserve a treat later on? I've been eating low in fat, and therefore I'll change what I ate for the rest of the day, and then it potentially causes other problems. Am I just overthinking this?
So when we consume our foods, there's loads and loads of factors that influence our food choices. There's hundreds. There's loads and loads of models that we can look at that influence. You know, there's do we like the taste of it, smell of it, appearance of it? How hungry am I? Where am I? Who am I with? How much money do I have? Am I upset, happy, sad, whatever? Social media is huge. Advertising is huge. So there's loads and loads of things that affect our whatever we choose. Now, if that product is, say, high in fat, there will be some people that will worry about it. There will be some people that act upon it. There will be some people that ignore it. So many, many people have what we call, it's a trade-off. That's what it's called. It's a trade-off in health. So they know they've had something, they've had a very large packet of biscuits, and they know it's very high in sugar and fat, but they don't actually care because they're going to go to the gym that evening. So in their mind, they trade it. So I honestly think that maybe that the trade-off fact is one way people do it. The others ignore it. They won't really take much notice. It's on special offer. It's buy one, get one free. Don't go there. So I think people tend to ignore areas that they think they can change. And we need to remember that food choices on our health are not based on a single choice of an item. They're based over a longer spread of time. And it's not on one single product. And if we could change in some ways, it's, I think, to become more interactive and to use an app which could measure this and come up with a figure. It's my nutrient scoring process that I'll go on to in a minute. You will be mm-hmm. so I will go on forever. so I think if we made this more interactive and people could actually measure and see what they consumed over a number of items, take away the confusion and the mathematical calculations, I think it would be a better way to proceed than looking at one item, whether we choose it, whether it's high in fat.
Yeah. So personalized nutrition issues kind of come in here, where people may be given an app, maybe even prescribed an app by the NHS. And then they can, yeah, hopefully, as long as the information is there on the pack with a little QR code, they don't even have to read it. They can just feed it into the app and it can say, nah, you don't want that, mate. I can move on. Now, the UK has one of the worst obesity rates in the world. And, you know, we wring our hands about this right here on the podcast. Over and over again, we've discussed it. Lots of people have come up with ways to tackle it. We haven't made a dent in obesity rates here in the UK. So, Zoe, what role have food labels played in where we are now? You know, would it have just been infinitely worse if we didn't have traffic light labelling? And what role could they possibly play in helping to reduce obesity?
So front of pack labels, they increase the transparency of what's really in food. It allows us to make clear, informed decisions, encourages food companies to reformulate their products, as I mentioned before. But it is only part of the solution of what is a really complex health condition. As Joe mentioned before, there are a lot of aspects that influence someone's decision to buy a product. It's not just healthiness. Likes and dislikes, you aren't going to be able to convince someone to buy something that they don't like. Cost, especially now in the cost of living. So what's on offer influences us, the marketing. So a range of measures are needed to improve our food environment, restrictions on unhealthy advertising and promotions, targets to reduce levels of salt and sugar in products so that people don't even need to make a change but can still benefit, better layouts of supermarkets to help us see healthier products, and the list can go on. So the government have set out a range of these policies that would impact obesity, particularly childhood obesity in the UK, but few have been implemented.
They promptly ditched them. Well, there's not implemented them. Yeah, that's true. That's the phrase to use.
lowered on their priority list, unfortunately. So we need to be realistic and acknowledge that many changes are needed so we can all live a healthier, happier and longer life. But food labels aren't going to and shouldn't be expected to do that by themselves.
Yeah. Joe, do you have a view on this? And maybe to add to it, you know, it's not just the traffic light system, but other information on labels, or is that just a blunt tool?
I think, as Zoe said, it's one part of a huge complicated jigsaw. And I think we need to question. So I did a few stats, looked up a few stats that were from the House of Commons in January 2023. And it says 25.9% of adults in England, so not Wales, Scotland, Ireland, et cetera, are obese. 37.9% are overweight. And men are more likely to be overweight or obese than women, which is interesting when I come to my second part. People aged 45 to 74 are most likely to be overweight or obese. So why is that? Since 1993, the proportion of adults in England who are overweight and obese, has risen from 52.9 to 64.3. And this is also more prevalent in deprived areas of England, which is well documented. And we need to sort of understand that in our complexity. And I found this really interesting. Is children aged 4 to 5 were 10% were obese in 21-22. And 12.1% were overweight. But when you get to year 6 at primary school, at age 10 to 11, 23% were obese. It doubled.
It is extraordinary, isn't it? Yeah.
The thing is, in both age groups, in the 4 to 5 and the 10 to 11, boys are more likely to be overweight than girls. And when you look at males are more likely to be overweight than women, we need to ask so many more questions of whether or not a food label changes this. But why are we not looking at these stats? And why are we not looking at this problem of obesity as there just seems so many starts and stops to so many programs and nothing seems joined up, in my humble opinion.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we have got a massive problem. I don't know the answer. If I did, I'd be extremely rich. And
yeah,
I'd be living in some beach island somewhere. I'm not, I'm here.
Now, Joe, you've done some work with secondary school children around labelling, haven't you?
I have, yes.
Can you tell us a bit about it and what you tried to discover?
Of course. Stop me when I keep going, because it's years. For my stupidity, I did a PhD, and I was drawn to sort of this target group that's really missed off of adolescents. I find it a complicated word to say, quite frankly. So they have this, what I call adolescent cloud. So who published data on children 5 years and younger and children between 5 and 19? And yet who defined adolescence as actually age between 10 and 19? So what they define them and what they publish their results of obesity are not the same. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention of Obesity published their data on adolescents between 12 and 19. So there's bits that miss. So if we've got these huge statistics that say there are this group of adolescents out there, and this is the proportion that are obese, if they tied in and reported on the same levels, would this be actually higher? Which is quite a frightening thought. Anyway, so whilst I was doing a lecture on food labels at the university, I came across something that I thought was genius, and it was called Nouval. Don't know if you've heard of it. It's a scoring system. It's in America, and supermarkets have to pay, and everything is scored. The algorithm, it's done by a gentleman by the name of David Katz, and Nouval is still going, but not necessarily down this scoring route. And unfortunately, it was a big trade secret, so he didn't give me the algorithm. I couldn't be. I tried really hard. But anyway, he wasn't to be. But they took on loads and loads of, unlike we take on whether it's saturated fat and take, you know, say yes or no to traffic light systems, they include omega-3, omega-6, omega-9, and loads and loads of other compounds. And I thought, what an amazing idea. You look at two lots of frozen fish fingers or something in a shelf, and one might be 64 and the other one might be 52. And you go, well, you know which one is more nutritious? It's not rocket science, but it's very straightforward. And I thought, wouldn't that be genius? I thought we could put that in schools because schools potentially, if they have a school meal, potentially provide a 33% of an adolescent's calories in a day. But there's no guideline as to what is the most healthy choice on the menu. Why not? Why is there no, although it's legislated, you know, you must meet this particular formula, it doesn't say whether or not pizza, jacket, potato or the roast chicken dinner, which one is the healthiest? Just put a star on it, you know, put a number on it.
So
I found four schools in Greater London. There were mixed socioeconomic status, range of ethnicity, which I thought was good. And it contained four areas. I will try and be as quick as I can because 7 years is quite hard to condense in 5 minutes.
I can feel the pain there.
I'm so much to say. Shut me up now. So I did four parts. I did a quantitative sort of experiment, and I scored the food, and I saw if I scored the food, would that increase? Would the scores increase? Because the higher the score, the more nutritious the food. Would the sales change when I implemented the score? Or would they stay the same, which meant there was no effect? Or would they go down, which meant they were completely wasting my time? Their children were, the adolescents were. So I did that, and then I did a focus group as to, did they understand it? How did it make them feel? What were their thought processes about it? And then the other part, which isn't, well, we don't have time for today. No, we don't, is the factors that affect their food choices. What did affect their food choices more than anything else? That was a quantitative one on a questionnaire. I got 3,000 back. It was a big study. And then I also did a focus group with the same group of people and said, explain why you put taste as number one. What does it mean to you? And what are the factors that affect your choices? So if I keep to the food label as such, I scored the food using, the, I don't know if you can remember this, but there was a restriction on advertising of unhealthy food to children on television. And it was done through Ofcom, and Ofcom needed a way to say, what can I allow to be regulated on television and what am I not to allow to be regulated on television? So the Food Standards Agency went to Professor Mike Rayner from the British Heart Foundation, who did a formula. And if it had 4+, it was less healthy. So only foods that scored 4 and above were allowed to be regulated. I happened to meet this charming gentleman at a conference, and he was much nicer than David Katz, and he gave me his algorithm. How happy was I? I think I'd still be there measuring my foods, believe me. So we did a trial, and we selected 15 foods that were a mixture of foods that were in the top 15 sales, and they had to have a mixture of what would be termed as healthy as you can get to mediumly healthy to not as healthy. And I worked with the dietitians for the school catering company. They were amazing. They were really helpful. The chefs were helpful. The school environment was brilliant. I was amazed at such quality of the food in the schools today. Hats off to them for, you know, giving our younger generation such a great start in life. If they went down the school meal route, it was phenomenal. I was seeking to look for bad things, and I was struggling to find them. So put basically, I measured the sales of these 15 items at four schools, and they'd all been given a score, but the scores were not visible to the pupils. And I measured that as my baseline sales. So it was 3-week menu cycle. Then I measured it again for 3 weeks when the scores were visible, and then again for 3 weeks scores when it was visible yet again. Now, the complication came, that was the easy bit, believe me. The complication came when I had to inform them how it was working. So I did this awareness pack, as it was called. I think it was, I don't like the word awareness pack particularly, but I couldn't call it education. It was sort of in between. So I gave every tutor in every classroom a postcard which said the higher the number, the better your health is, the better your healthier your food is. And I had posters around, and the tutors all had to read out the same message for consistency to all of their form groups as to this is what is happening in your restaurant, your school restaurant. So I was hoping that would really, you know, be a consistent message. And so anyway, so I got the results back, and unfortunately it didn't particularly pan out. Only in one school did I see an increase in the food score, but this was not significantly different, so it was termed a trend.
Yeah,
I found, obviously, throughout that all that hard work quite disappointing, but I found that when I got to the focus groups, these were very interesting. I found that, first of all, that, oh, so when I look at my quantitative data, it didn't work apart from one school showed a trend. But what was interesting is there was no difference in gender who noticed the food score, but there was a difference in the fact that more males said that it would influence their food choices more than females, which goes against most of the culture. So when I had my focus groups and talked to them, most of them didn't have the postcards and didn't understand it. So they didn't see it. They didn't know it was there. They didn't know what it meant. Many thought it meant calories. So there was a bit of a chat about that. Yeah. When I asked them and I said, so do you want a food label? Nearly everyone said yes, which was well, you know, hey, they said yes. And I gave them some food labels to choose from. The ones that were very interested in sport, like the calories and the physical activity label, which tells them how many calories they'd burn by, you know, running if they eat a ham sandwich, for example, which they all had sport at the back of their mind. The one that liked the traffic light system, when you went through their transcripts in the focus groups, they were more interested in health. They talked about their dads doing the cooking, lots of vegetables, talk of nutrition around the dinner table. But some said, doesn't matter what you give me, I'm not going to use it. But the majority of them said they want a simple symbol, whether it be a thumbs up, a heart, a tick, something that was a summary, what's known as a summary system, a summary food label sums up all the things, whereas a nutrient specific is like a traffic light.
Yeah.
So it didn't work per se, but I did.
But fascinating results, even though it didn't work, I think.
Well, I think so. And if I had another 4 hours to tell you about the other session. another day, Stefan.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yes. Okay. I think it's fascinating that there wasn't a change. And adolescents are an interesting group because it's almost like, I think a lot of schools kind of go, okay, it's out of our hands now. You know, they might eat at the canteen. They might nip down Greg's or Mackie D's and eat there instead. So we're just, if they eat here at all, then we're happy. Now, Zoe, let's look at some of the solutions, and not at potential solutions that we can talk about, because as we've all said, I think it's a really complex idea. But are there any countries around the world where they're doing this kind of thing and having any success?
Yeah, so Chile, Mexico and Peru, for example, have gone for a mandatory front of pack warning label. So these highlight if a product is over a specific threshold for example, salt, saturated fat and calories. Even in just a few years since they were introduced, evidence is coming through that they have helped reduce the purchases of less healthy products, that the food industry have reduced levels of salt and sugar, for example, to avoid having the warning labels on their products. And also that children are able to recognize and understand these warning labels and are even acting as an advocate for their family to buy less of these products that have got this warning label. As with everything, more evidence, I'm sure, will emerge over time on this. And then similarly with, for example, in France and Spain, they have the Nutri-Score, which is similar to kind of what Joe's been talking about. It gives a score from A to E, and it is colour-coded, similar to the UK traffic light. So it's kind of going through the oranges and greens and reds. And that gives a balance of salt, sugar and saturated fat against the more positive elements like fruit and vegetables, protein and fibre. So these labels, we found that they need a lot more education, because A doesn't necessarily mean really healthy, just healthier on balance than others, which can be confusing. So UK is a good example also of what is being done well. But again, it would be better if it was made mandatory as well. And it's recognised already in the UK. Industry use it as a guide to lower their levels of sugar, salt and saturated fat. So again,
and that's a good thing.
Exactly, that's a good thing. We just need to look at it further, look at more of the evidence and further, see how we can improve it further. So not necessarily scrap it, because we've got it and people understand it, people are aware of it. So yeah, all of you've got warning labels, Nutri-Score and the UK's traffic light system that are all doing quite well.
They're a positive thing rather than negative thing. It's a start. Okay, so my last question for both of you to wrap this up is really, let's put food labelling aside, because are we barking up the wrong tree? Is labelling something that we should be spending all of this time that we spent today talking about? Or is there something more important? Is there another aspect of this that we should be tackling? Joe, I mean, there's lots of things, not just obesity rates, but lots of other issues. Should we be taking a different view of how to change people's diets for the better?
Well, if we're looking at labelling per se, I do agree with Zoe. I think we need to make it mandatory. We need everyone to comply. It needs to be wider across the food chain than it is.
Less of a wishy-washy food regulator, basically. That's what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, yes. And UK don't, if you saw what I mean. We wouldn't put warnings because we're very soft. We're very gentle.
And because our consumers would hate to be pushed around on one level or maybe given the information on another.
Let's not go there. I mean, a good skull and crossbones on a Mexican warning list, I think, would really do the trick.
You're going to die! Yeah, no, that's not working.
72 hours left. I agree the fact that obviously A to E in France and the Nutri-Score is good. It was quite interesting in my one, was one of the things that Zoe focused on a little bit was education. And one of the things that my participants said to me is they didn't want 1 to 100 as a score. They wanted 1 to 10. But what they saw it as was 1 was the best and 10 was the least. So again, it's this education.
Gosh.
I know. But we went to, I was talking to them about what they learnt. And I've got the facts only from the school children. So I have backed it up a little bit and looked at online on the curriculum. But one of the things in the curriculum is that I do feel we need to spend longer on education. I just saw a plan of a lesson, and literally they did so many things in that 45 minutes. I was exhausted. Mm. And they needed to go slower and cover less, but cover it in depth. And this needs to be a joined up approach in doctor's surgeries, in health clinics, in our advertising, in the broader picture. And education is the key. And I do think if we're going to look at younger people, we need interaction, technology and apps for this to bring it forwards in great leaps and bounds. When people look at it and they can see it's affecting them, just like Mexico, Peru, etc., they get involved and they will pay more attention. So in my humble opinion, we need to focus on education, not just the simple traffic light system, which, as Zoe says, and I agree, it's here now. Let's make it better and let's get people to understand it.
Yeah. So, Zoe, it's an interesting idea, isn't it? Because, teachers are expected to do so much, and it's very easy to say, well, this should happen in class. I mean, the burden on teachers is vast already. As Joe said, they get through so much, and that's because there is so much to get through. Is it feasible to give the responsibility to teachers, and is there another way? I mean, also Joe mentioned technology as well. So do you have a view on that?
There's just not one solution. As I mentioned before, with the awareness, it shouldn't be one versus the other. Education awareness certainly does have a role to play, not necessarily just on teachers and schools either. You can have awareness campaigns from the government, an example being the Sid the Slug campaign many years ago about salt reduction. So there's many ways that it can be done. So it shouldn't just fall on teachers by any means. There's, as I said, it's not just one solution. When we're looking at food labels, yes, it can be improved. Yes, we could have a look at more of the positive nutrients. But then What we don't want to do is then have those as that health halo symbol. So particularly like protein, for example, that's come in, protein chocolate bars, coming on that trend that protein is good for us and we need more protein, but we don't necessarily, many of us don't necessarily need more protein in our diet.
Protein fortified sugar.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Salt with extra protein.
That's exactly what's happened. But actually fibre, for example, we do need to increase, but there's not that same. So how do we increase the fibre in people's diet without, again, using it as a health halo system? Similarly with increasing fruit and vegetable intake, but without using processed fruit and vegetables within a meal. So there's a lot to take into account. And we need to think as food labels, as part of a puzzle, similar to what Joe mentioned earlier, it needs to be as part of a puzzle. Obesity is more complex than just eating too much and not moving enough. You've got genetics, you've got sleep hygiene, you've got mental health and our food environment. They all need to be considered. Front pack labels alone can't possibly solve this. Education alone can't possibly solve this. That doesn't mean that they shouldn't exist. So to see an impact, they need to be made mandatory and the government need to implement all the other policies that they have looked into, that they have provided evidence for, that they have said will have an impact, as they have promised.
And follow it through.
And follow it through.
Yeah. Well said. Well said. Well, I think we've covered that pretty well, although there's still so many questions to answer. So perhaps we'll tackle this one again with both of you in the near future. So Joe Tucker and Zoe Davies, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much, Stefan.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. Now, I'd like to tell you about a series of events that we've got coming up. Food Matters Live Inspiring Nutrition is taking place on the 23rd and 24th of May. The events will explore the latest innovative solutions advancing sustainable nutrition. You can become a partner or apply to attend by searching Food Matters Live Inspiring Nutrition. Or email us at info@foodmatterslive.com. And thank you so much for listening.